Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure today to be joined by Michael Maiden, who's director of the China Energy Programme at the OIS, and Anders Hovey, who's project director for Energy Transition, GIZ, China, and they're here to discuss Michael's paper, COVID-19 and the Electrification of the Chinese Economy, and Anders' paper, Current Direction for the Renewable Energy in China. Guys, it's great to have you here. We've got Anders in Beijing, we've got Michael in North London, and I'm physically located about 20 miles south of London. So we've truly got a global podcast here today. So Michael, if I may, let's start with a question to you. The two sessions were widely anticipated as posts for China's economic and energy recovery post-COVID-19. What were the key messages related to the economy at that meeting?
Thanks, David. I think, you know, we have to bear in mind that the two sessions were delayed by 2 months. And so just by the fact that they convened, it was a very important sign that China was moving from epidemic control to resuming normality, or at least trying to. Of course, we've had additional outbreaks since then. This was at the end of May. But overall, China seems to be over the worst, hopefully, of this pandemic, and turning now to finalize some of its sort of 2020 goals, wrapping up the five-year plan. A key macro takeaway, I think, is that there was no GDP target. It was a first in over 30 years. But there was a pledge for sort of considerable fiscal firepower behind this recovery. Some monetary easing. I think the overall message was one of a focus away from sort of quantitative growth and GDP targets to employment, quality of living, really a qualitative shift.
Fascinating. And interesting, that's messages we're hearing in many other countries in the world as, of course, they come out of the COVID-19 pandemic. But, you know, what were the key energy-related messages?
And that was very interesting that this year the work report, the government work report, which is kind of the key feature of the two sessions. It was light on details for most things and energy too. Interestingly, though, energy security, the term energy security, made its first appearance in the work report since sort of throughout this five-year plan, so since 2016. And there was a specific energy section. In the past, lots of energy-related issues were discussed in consolidation, infrastructure, price reform, various kind of elements. This time, there was one bit on energy security. And actually, even though energy security, I think we typically think about it as kind of upstream development to reduce imports, this time it was very much about sort of the resilience of the supply system as a whole.
One other thing that links to that supply system, of course, is the issue of infrastructure. And, you know, and as in many economies, governments are planning to use infrastructure investment as means to actually restart their economies. So was this a key message at the two sessions meeting?
It was indeed. I mean, there was, again, a lot of focus on how much spending. I mean, it was promised at sort of all levels of government, central government, localities. And really, there was a key focus on sort of new urbanization and new infrastructure. So things like 5G, artificial intelligence, data centers, EV charging infrastructure and ultra-high voltage transmission lines.
And just building on that subject, if I may, with you, and welcome to the podcast. But surely, you know, COVID-19, the governments had already launched the new infrastructure plan in the past, and the addition of UHV power lines seems to be a positive signal. Really, is that a positive signal, especially for renewables?
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of things I'd note about the infrastructure plan. First of all, as you note, the new infrastructure plan had been launched previous to the crisis, and it's not designed specifically to respond to the crisis. As well, many of the things that the new infrastructure plan targets might be more long-term. The long-distance power lines typically do take many years to fully construct. And then there's the concern that many long-distance lines, even those that are marked and designated as for clean energy, might nevertheless be connected primarily to coal bases. The other aspect, I think, is that when the infrastructure elements were discussed, they weren't discussed as part of a stimulus package. And I really haven't heard these terms like green stimulus used in the Chinese context. So, you know, the idea that EV charging is part of a green stimulus, I don't think that's really the way it's perceived here. I think that more this is seen as a way to modernize the economy.
And in your paper, you talk about that you say that the overall policy theme is clear, stable growth of clean energy. So I think that my question is, you know, will the COVID-19 actually accelerate China's energy transition? What do you think?
I think that it has the potential to accelerate certain factors, but I would say that broadly speaking, it currently doesn't look like it's likely to play a major catalyzing role, either in accelerating retirements or accelerating the shift away from fossil investments, or in shifting the nature of the discussion. I haven't seen that shift in China as I have in some other areas of the world. And in other industries of the world. I think in China currently, energy policy is really focused on, as Michal mentioned, energy security, number one, but also on the idea of staying stable over the long term in all respects and focusing on keeping existing plans in motion rather than entirely moving in new directions.
So perhaps for our listeners, you could just kind of give your vision as to what the energy transition could look like in China.
Well, I think one thing that's very important to note is that we are either already at or on the cusp of a situation where wind and solar are at parity with coal prices. And that's in a situation where you do not have carbon pricing or really significant environmental taxes on the coal sector. So the externalities of coal are not considered, but the prices for renewable energy now are coming to the point where you don't necessarily need a lot of subsidies, and it's more other types of policies that are needed. And in that type of environment, there is a major potential, but also a major risk that renewables, by becoming competitive with the incumbent players, start to really take off, driven by the favorable pricing dynamics. But at the same time, that poses a risk also that administrative procedures might come into play as a way to favor the incumbent players and kind of stabilize the system in the sense of not enabling that takeoff. And I think that's what we've seen from a lot of commentary, where the experts in China are saying, look, this we're going to prioritize renewable development, but we're not going to go in the direction of explosive growth like we might have seen in past eras.
Michal, Anders mentioned a couple of minutes ago energy security, you know, and I understand that together with food security, it is listed by the government as a key focus area. Now, from an energy perspective, does China have to be worried about energy security? What do you think?
It does feel a bit counterintuitive that, you know, we are today in a world of abundant oil supplies and cheap, relatively, abundant gas supplies, but also, of course, abundant coal supplies. There seems to be everything available in the markets, and yet China is sort of drumming this kind of energy security mantra again. I think we have to take it in the context of the swift changes in market conditions. It's about supplies, but about the resilience and being able to deal with swift changes in markets, but of course also in the context of US-China tensions and the sort of steady and ongoing deterioration in those. So I think when you combine the two, then really there is what Anders was talking about, this the theme of resilience and stability, and that is sort of impacting the development of renewables, but also resilience and stability, and that leads China back to coal.
Well, just building upon that, actually, and if I'd like to go back to you, if I may, about this kind of this post-COVID recovery and whether it's green or whether it's brown, because in your paper, you say that continuing additions of global fired power capacity has also played a role in reducing renewable additions, and that planners and provincial officials continue to see coal essential for reliability. So surely, you know, China is going to remain a coal-based energy country, isn't it?
I think that that is what a lot of the officials are planning on currently. The electrification of the economy, which is portrayed as part of the transition towards clean energy in many parts of the world, here seems to be also a way to justify additional coal-fired capacity to make sure that not only can China ensure the power system is reliable, but also to make sure that each province has sufficient supply and capacity to meet its needs. And it does appear that the discount factor applied to renewable energy, which is variable in its nature, is higher than would be typical in other countries that have a much larger percentage of renewable energy. So you see a lot of provinces being marked as experiencing shortages, even though they're just adjacent to a large province with surplus capacity. And you don't see as much trading between the provinces as you'd expect. And you see those provinces that are marked as having shortages approving more coal plants to meet their domestic, let's say, in-province demand. Recently, just this last week, we saw a PowerPoint that came out of State Grid that was putting forward a kind of a glide path for 2025 to see additions of 300 gigawatts of coal-fired capacity. So that's more than I've seen before. And that was being mentioned just in the context of how to meet demand growth in the context of electrification of the economy. And I think it was very interesting that on this slide, they mentioned sort of international uncertainty as a potential variable that it could affect the amount of coal additions. But the Paris Climate Agreement was not mentioned there. The China's National Determined Contributions target to peak coal, to peak carbon emissions around 2030 was not mentioned on that slide. So I think that right now, China's planners are really focused on making sure that they meet the electricity demand growth as being portrayed as quite robust, and coal as being portrayed as the main solution for meeting that demand growth.
Not a surprising response, I have to say, you know, because it is economic recovery that, of course, is important post-COVID. Can I come back to you, Mikhail? I'd like to talk for a minute, if I may, about technology. Because in your paper, you're very clear that technology is key. You know, what do the government recovery plans tell us about the role of technology and digitalization in China's energy future?
I think it's a really good point. And I think it's important to note, as Anders mentioned earlier, that sort of none of these plans are new, right? None of these infrastructure investments, they take a long time. And they've been in the works. It's the Made in China 2025. It's the kind of bigger rebalancing and upgrading of China's industry, which have been in the works for a long time. I think COVID-19 plus US-China tensions and concerns about sort of the decoupling of technological decoupling from the West, we're seeing it, right, with Huawei and concerns that Chinese companies could be cut off from Western markets is really prompting Beijing to accelerate its sort of technological self-sufficiency at the very least. I mean, if China can dominate some of those global technologies and become sort of a leader, that would be great. But I think the first point really is to become self-sufficient. And this push, which is an industrial, it's a technological push. And I think, as Anders mentioned, it's not necessarily a green stimulus. It is just a support mechanism. But what it will end up doing is electrifying the Chinese economy perhaps more rapidly than would have otherwise been the case.
Anders, just following on from this, you know, in your paper, you note that the renewable additions were slowing in China before the COVID-19 pandemic. I think it was about a 30% reduction in solar PV additions 2019 versus 2017. Why was that happening, and how has COVID-19 impacted on that?
Yeah, the trend was clearly underway that the installations of solar were down. And this was really due to a cut in subsidies, or more specifically, a cut in the quota for the amount of projects that would qualify for the subsidized feed-in tariff. And the market for solar did recover towards the end of the year, but it was never going to get back to the very heavy growth rates that were seen a couple of years ago. And so overall, the total installations of wind and solar in 2019 were down. And I think that in a way, you could say that that is bad, but it was also very much a shift, as I mentioned before, towards the sort of grid parity projects, towards distributed solar, towards projects essentially competing on a level playing field with coal. And that means both that the subsidy burden for the state would be reduced, but in addition, it also means that in the future, if prices for wind and solar continue to fall, these power sources are going to start growing again much more rapidly than they had seen in the past.
Could be coming up to something we were talking earlier on about the economic impact of COVID-19 on the whole Chinese economy. Could that worsen the position further, as you've already seen that FIT tariffs were wound down beforehand?
Yeah, I think that for the most part, there will still be obligations for provinces to obtain a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable energy. In addition, there will still be other support measures for wind and solar. So, for example, the National Energy Administration has announced that about 26 gigawatts of solar, I believe, will qualify for long-term power contracts that are, you know, roughly competitive with grid prices. So there are going to be other support measures that enabled these markets to remain stable, even in a situation where power demand dips. However, I would have to say that the overall electricity demand, according to the statistics I've seen, has not really dipped that much. It's not a situation where you would see expectations for electricity demand just falling so dramatically that all investment in across the sector would stop. That's not what's happening here. So people are expecting a stable or growing market for wind and solar this year.
Mikhail, if I could jump back to you, one of the titles of your sections really stood out to me as I read your fascinating paper. What's the matter with renewables? I found that actually very telling. So could you perhaps share with our listeners what you meant by that?
I think it's sort of just to point out that there is a context and a perspective that is required here, because when you look at China's renewable development, it is something of a mixed bag. You know, China's the world's largest market, leading global manufacturer of renewables. It has met and even exceeded some of its five-year plan targets, but now that growth is slowing. And I think we are coming to a point which is really the crux of the issue for China. It's kind of the state versus the market. You know, China needs to be moving from adding supplies and building the hardware that it's really, really good at, to managing demand and improving the kind of software, right? The connections, the trading between provinces that Anders was talking about. And that has proven historically also to be the more challenging part for this kind of state-guided economy that is China. Now, it's not impossible, it's just harder. And I think we're at an interesting point in time where lots of observers are pointing to the need for market reforms in China in order to help renewables develop. And yet it's an open question how quickly we get those reforms. And, you know, we're talking about renewable obligation targets for provinces. So administrative ways that China is trying to get renewables onto the grid, even though they're already at parity. So economically, they could work. But again, so it's this contradiction between market reforms and China's ability to actually move ahead with them. And I think that here, the growth will slow. Does that mean that China's abandoning its renewable targets? Not at all. But the focus is moving from stellar to stable. And I think we've gotten used to a sector that's been outperforming for at least a decade. So this might feel like a bit of a letdown.
Anders, just come back to you, if I may, perhaps looking a bit more kind of to the future trajectory for renewables. Because in quarter one, we saw an increase in renewable power generation while overall power use fell. Is that giving us a message as to what the future could look like for renewables in China?
I think the choice of words is excellent. It could look like, but I don't think it's really a signal per se. I think it is an indication that some of the market reforms Mikhail mentioned are actually starting to take effect, and I think that and become binding. So the fact that renewables saw that growth during a period when electricity consumption was down is an indication that rules that had been put into place and reemphasized over the years that renewables should take priority in dispatch, that there are minimum operating hours for renewable plants that must be upheld, that provinces are unable to trade renewables across boundaries. That is an indication that some of those reforms were working and that renewables did take priority in dispatch, whereas you might expect that in a crisis, the system would revert to its more traditional roles where we would give a lot of operating hours to the largest state-owned companies to make sure that they stay afloat, and we would cut back a little bit on everybody equally so that nobody is disadvantaged in hard times. Yeah. But yeah, I don't think that it's really a signal of what will happen, but I do think it's a signal of what could happen.
Well, Mikhail, if I can come back to you, I was interested in your paper. It said, you asked the question, is China electrifying faster than it's decarbonizing? I thought that was an interesting question. And I expect, you know, that also links back to the government's work report at the NPC in 2020, which seemed to tone down the support for anti-pollution efforts. So is there a strong commitment to environmental goals? And what are the obstacles to clean energy in China today? What do you think, Mikhail?
I feel that, you know, I think the government has certainly not abandoned its commitment to renewables and to environmental goals. But the direction of travel does look as though we are on an accelerated path towards electrification and a stable path towards decarbonization. And those two timings just don't fit. So it does lead to faster electrification than decarbonization. But I think we really need to wait and see where the 14th five-year plan comes down. There's a huge debate between coal and renewables and, again, the direction of travel. I think in the West, we tend to see it as either or, whereas in China, I think we can look at it as kind of pendulum swings in policy. We will get both. It might not be the most economic efficient way of doing things, but I think we will get fossil fuels and renewables. That's not perhaps what we need for Paris targets. We need more ambition, not less. We need sort of more rather than stability. But still, I think China is firmly committed to protecting the environment. It's still one of the three critical battles. But of course, post-COVID-19, there will be a very different outlook between what the central government is saying and what the provinces are likely to do. And so again, I think this that there have been concerns that the GDP targets this year were shelved and so were green goals. But again, this is going to be, China's going to get there in its own way. The pace, I think, is slightly worrying.
And did you want to chip in on make an observation?
I just wanted to mention on the fact that this is really a critical year for both the climate talks as well as for the five-year plan. And I think that there's a target now for non-fossil energy to meet 20% of energy demand by 2030. And then the China's nationally determined contributions commitment calls for the country to peak carbon emissions around 2030. And since we've been talking a lot about renewable capacity additions, China is still going to be adding like 20 to 40 gigawatts each of wind and solar. It would be the largest market still for those technologies. But we need to probably scale that up to about 100 or 150 gigawatts per year each by the middle to end of this decade in order to hit the Paris Climate Agreement. So stable doesn't quite hit the Paris Climate Agreement. And I think all the signals are that the current environment is not amenable, let's say, to adjusting those 2030 targets.
Well, look, Mikael Anderson, we've covered a lot of subjects over the past 25 minutes. You know, I think I always like to end up my podcasts with a kind of quite a general question, you know, how do you think everything's going to end up? You know, and we haven't really discussed the deteriorating US-China relations as well. And, you know, and how that's kind of potentially going to impact even further on security of supply requirements for China. So, Mikael, let me come to you first. How? What's the end game? Where are we looking at over the next 5-10 years? What do you think?
I think the US-China relations are going to be critical over the next 5 years. The direction of travel in China, it's hard to change, right? We're seeing, even though the pace might change and China might not be going fast enough in order to meet the Paris targets that we need, it's still on track to add renewables to its system, to continue to electrify its economy. But the tensions with the US are reshifting the focus, I think, to this technological dominance, to supply security and to coal. And I think that's where it will become an increasingly challenging world to operate in. This bifurcation of standards, if that's even possible, this decoupling might not be possible, but because of this narrative and because of these increasing tensions globally, I think the energy space won't be able to escape it. We're already seeing that, I think, in reduced ambition from China on its Paris goals. Now, maybe there could be a step up with the EU, with China and the EU coming up with sort of increased ambition. But really, I think geopolitics are making a massive comeback into energy.
Of course, and we're heading towards the US election, and who knows what's going to happen there. Anders, I'm going to give you the last word, if I may. No, I think the end game more asking you that. You know, what's the end game in your perspective? What do you think?
Well, I hope we're not at the end game yet, but I think that the if I could, you know, I think we all know that there, when it comes to climate and when it comes to climate policy, there are a lot of reasons for pessimism. But maybe if I could just put it a little bit more on a long-term basis. That when I came to China 10 years ago, actually 10 years ago yesterday, was my first day in China. When I came to China, solar was considered a technology which was inappropriate for China and too expensive and only for export. And wind was considered something that could be subsidized in China, but should require financial assistance from foreign countries. And today, wind and solar combined are about 10% of electricity sales in China, and that's growing by 1% per year. And when I came to China, I spoke to a U.S. senator, and I told about how some of the fuel mix in China was changing on a 1% per year basis in China, and that was quite revolutionary compared to what was happening in the United States. And nowadays, seeing the electricity mix in the U.S. or Europe or a given country in Europe change by only 1% per year would be seen as quite modest, and we're seeing actually a revolution in energy consumption and production in Europe right now, and in the United States, I'd say as well. So I think that we can expect that eventually the economics are going to take hold. The technology is going to prove its worth. And China will get on the train in terms of adopting renewables at scale and really decarbonizing its grid. It's a ways away yet, I think it's clear, but I think we'll get there.
Well, with that optimism from both of you, I have to say, in these difficult times as we sit here, I didn't mention recording it, you know, on the 8th of July, and a lot is happening, of course, as we talk. But no, thank you both of you for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from your papers, you know, the current direction of renewable energy in China and COVID-19 and the electrification of the Chinese economy. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.